This episode may contain content of a graphic nature, including descriptions of physical and sexual violence against adults, children, and animals. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone. I'm Talia.
And I'm Tanya.
And together we are Crimes and Consequences, a true crime podcast.
That night of this incident?
Yes.
I did. And how did I hurt you?
You stabbed me.
Hi, Tanya.
Hi, Talia.
Welcome back, everybody. I have a really interesting episode that was very difficult for me to write up. I'm sure many of you have heard the Ronnie O'Neill story.
I've heard of it. I just don't know all the details.
The details are horrifying. I'm sure you've seen clips of the court trial.
Oh, yeah. It was insanity.
That's a shit show.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got some of them. But anyway, this is a fascinating story. It's very sad and it's very gruesome. On that note,
let's do it.
Let's do it. If you haven't done so already, please hit the subscribe/follow button. And I'm going to start. You've all been clearly warned, right?
Yes.
Okay. On March 18th in 2018, so this is not even 4 years ago, the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Department received 3 911 calls from the Royal Lake Subdivision in Riverview, Florida, within a time span of 10 minutes. It was 11:43 p.m. when the first call came from Kenyatta Barron, known as Kiki. The audio for that 911 call is really muffled. It's hard to discern exactly what she's saying. And later on, you'll hear the judge describe how horrible this phone call is. In the phone call, the 33-year-old mother of two can be heard whispering to the operator, "I'm shot. Help. Help me, please." Followed by screaming. She was yelling out, "I'm so sorry, Ronnie. I'm trusting you. I trust everything you do. I love you. Allahu Akbar." Ronnie is Ronnie O'Neill III, Kiki's 29-year-old ex-boyfriend and the father of her two children. He can be overheard during the phone call screaming, "Say it again." Then the operator hears,
"What is the address?" "Hello, ma'am. Where is the gun?" "What is it? Who did this?"
It is horrifying because she screams. Then Ronnie yells out, "Allahu Akbar." Then the dispatcher hears a male voice, it's Ronnie, yelling out, quote, "Get in here and kill this bitch right now," end quote. He's yelling that to his 7-year-old son, Ronnie the Fourth, commanding the boy to come in and kill his mother. Next, Kiki is heard during the call saying, quote, "I'm so sorry. Help me. I can't move my arm. My arm is shot up. Ronnie, please." Time elapses, 4 minutes to be exact. There are more noises, more screaming, thumping, and then Kiki's cries for help go silent. During that 911 phone call, she'd managed to run out her front door and over to her neighbor's house, screaming and pounding on the neighbor's door. James Gray Jr. happened to be there. He was visiting his fiance, who is now his wife, and her young daughter was there. The three of them heard this commotion coming from the front door, and then the sound of a gunshot resonated throughout the street, rattling other neighbors out of bed. This type of violence was unheard of in the middle-class Royal Lakes subdivision. It just wasn't that kind of an area. By the time James opened the front door, Kiki was no longer there, pounding on it. Ronnie had caught up with her. And all that James could see in the darkness were two silhouettes at the end of his fiancée's 8-foot foyer. They were on the sidewalk, and blood was all over the foyer wall. James cried out to his fiancée to stay back and to call 911. And that's when the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Department received its second 911 call about the incident. At this point, Kiki was laying motionless, face down on the ground, while Ronnie stood over her, holding on to her left arm. And he started rambling something that James couldn't quite understand. 6 minutes after Kiki first placed her 911 call, at 11:49 p.m., the Hillsborough County Police received their third 911 call from that area. And this time, it was from Ronnie. And here's the call.
911, what is your emergency?
Hey, I've just been attacked by some white demons inside Kiki. Kiki, her name is Kiki. And she tried to kill me.
After making the call, Ronnie ran back inside the family home while James ran to the aid of Kiki, who was bleeding out on the sidewalk, basically. It's like a foyer. It's described as a foyer and it's described as a sidewalk. James remained with Kiki outside until the paramedics arrived. Unfortunately, between the time she first placed her call and the time the paramedics arrived, Kiki died.
Oh.
Inside Kiki's home, Ronnie continued his campaign of terror, targeting his two children, little Ronnie and little Ronnie's 9-year-old sister, Renivia. These two poor children witnessed a prolonged attack on their mother by their father only minutes earlier and were in that house just praying for someone to save them from this nightmare. And then their dad walks back in.
Oh, no.
Renivia, her nickname was Nivy, she'd already experienced more challenges than most children in her 9 years of life. She was born premature at 28 weeks. As a result, she was a paraplegic with cerebellar hypoplasia and autism. Her mother, Kiki, did everything in her power to enrich Renivia's life and help her reach her full potential. She was a great mom. She made sure her room was fit for a princess.
Aww.
In fact, there were Disney princess stickers all over it. And she would send Renivia off to school. And Renivia went to a special school for her specific needs. With super large bows in her hair that always matched her outfit.
Oh, how adorable.
Renivia was described as a happy child who, although was nonverbal, she was still able to use some sign language, and that's how she communicated with little Ronnie, who absolutely adored his sister. At school, Renivia was recognized with an award for her positive attitude. And I think she's a testament to how life can deal you a bad hand. And although her life was difficult, she made the most of it and didn't seem to let it bring her down. Kiki tried really hard to make her home a very loving home. On her fridge, she had 4 magnets. They said faith, hope, family, and love. And now those magnets had blood spatter all over them. Inside the home after killing Kiki, Ronnie immediately targeted Renivia. She was now left at the mercy of her once very loving father, a man who was about to commit the ultimate betrayal of her trust. And unlike her mother, she couldn't run away. She couldn't move. Ronnie attacked his daughter. And when he finished with her, he turned his attention to little Ronnie and continued the massacre on his family. It would be just after midnight when the Hillsborough County Sheriff's Department arrived to the 3-bedroom stucco ranch located at 13248 Pike Lake Drive. When they got there, Kiki was found laying face down on the sidewalk, wearing only her tank top, underwear, and socks, which were completely covered in her blood. Her face evidenced a brutal beating. Pieces of a shotgun, including the barrel, the wooden stock, and the mechanical components, lay within feet of her. The barrel was bent from the beating that she took.
He beat her with the shotgun?
Yes.
Oh my God.
It was clear to first responders that she was gone. There was no saving her. It had been Kiki's kind heart that ultimately led to her demise. And I read a whole bunch of articles in which everybody implied that Kiki and Ronnie were boyfriend and girlfriend. But that is not accurate at all. Although their relationship had been on and off for years, at this point in the story, it was just off. There was no romantic feelings towards each other. In fact, Ronnie had fathered a son. He had a small, brand new baby by another woman named Aisha Robinson. Kiki had only let Ronnie move into her house because she felt sorry for him. Less than a year earlier, Ronnie was the victim of a random, near-fatal drive-by. It took him quite a while to recover from that, and after his release from the hospital, neither Aisha nor his family or any of his friends would give him a place to stay. So Kiki did. Against the urging of her family, they were like, don't let him in. And there has to be a reason why nobody else wanted him to live with them either. Unlike Ronnie, Kiki had her life together. She had a job and she was attending college. Ronnie, on the other hand, had no steady income. He had tried to get into the Marines, but he failed the entrance exam. After failing the Marine entrance exam, he just ended up working odd jobs. Like he was a truck driver, and he worked at a casino, but he was often unemployed and spent a lot of his time recording hip-hop music in a makeshift recording studio that he set up in the garage.
So he was going to be a star.
I guess, in his own mind. And ironically, he is well known now, but not for the right reasons. Although he had no career and he had no steady income, he was a devoted father. And he spent a lot of time doting on his children, which makes this story really surprising to me. There was no history at all of child protective service intervention or anything I could read that said anything negative about him as a father before this horrible night. There were no indications in the previous months or years that Ronnie could be capable of such a horrific massacre. I haven't even gone into all the details yet, but it's a bloodbath. The police had been called to Kiki's home once before, and that was in May of 2015. So that was about 3 years before this incident. And that was over some really stupid incident in which Ronnie and Kiki had been arguing back and forth about his use of her car. At some point, he took a car jack and he threw it in the windshield and yelled at her that if I can't drive this car, no one can. So that's the extent of their relationship as far as any involvement with the police. I know Ronnie had been arrested for weed a couple times, but neighbors and relatives deny ever having any cause for concern in regards to violence in the home. He didn't have any history of mental health issues or substance abuse issues or even erratic behavior. However, after he recovered from that nearly fatal drive-by shooting, Ronnie changed. Although he was raised a Baptist and he sang in the church choir as a child, he became a devout member of the Nation of Islam. And he'd recently been pressuring Kiki to join, which is something she was absolutely 100% not interested in. On the night of the incident, when the police and firefighters arrived to the scene, all the lights in the home were off. But a minute later, an officer observed a dim light coming from the corner of the home, and the light grew brighter really quickly. Law enforcement realized that a fire had been started in the home. And at that point, they decided, okay, we got to get in. Forget a warrant. Forget the risks. We're going into this house. And they ended up breaking the front door down. When they did so, they yelled for anybody inside to get out. And one firefighter His name was David Foster. He later testified at court.
I could see a faint orange glow somewhat off to my left.
The main living room was engulfed in flames. He dropped to the ground and he began crawling through the home. He started slipping. He looked down.
And I realized that the floor was covered in blood.
The house's floor was just covered with blood. Knives were all over the floor, and as he crawled through the kitchen, he could see that one of the kitchen drawers was open. He made his way down the hallway where the bedrooms were, and as he did so, he passed by a gas can and something that was described as lawn equipment, but I'm not sure exactly what it was. As he was crawling farther down the hallway, he passed by a closed door, and he could feel this intense heat coming from the other side of the door, and he knew there had to be a second blaze going on in that bedroom. But the smoke was blinding. He felt around, eventually touched what he recognized as a door handle. When he opened the door, the entire room was engulfed in flames.
Everything in the room was on fire, so clothes, wall, ceiling. Once again, visibility was limited.
He had his hose, and he'd been hosing down in front of him. But when he opened that door and he got in, he handed his hose to somebody that was behind him. And he took his hands, and he was feeling around the floor. There was this pile of debris, and then he could feel under the debris what appeared to be a human leg. He pushed the debris aside, and then David Foster lifted the limp body of 9-year-old Renivia from the floor. And he carried her outside onto the lawn, treating her as if she was a patient. But then he saw her mutilated body, and he knew that she was dead.
What did you do then?
Hug my other firefighter and cry, to be honest with you.
Little Renivia had been stabbed multiple times, and she had burn injuries. She was pronounced dead at the scene at 12:30 a.m. While all that was going on and the firefighters had just broken inside the door, and I told you they yelled for anybody inside to come out, the automatic garage door slowly opened, and someone walked out of it. It was a boy. He was covered in blood. His clothes were smoldering. Blood was dripping out of his mouth, and he was holding his intestines in his hands. It was 7-year-old little Ronnie.
Oh, dude, hold on. Give me a second here.
Isn't that awful?
Okay.
His arms and legs were badly burned, and one of his lungs had collapsed. Officers ran to him, and the first thing he said to them was, "My father killed my mother."
Oh.
He was laid on the grass, and while they were attending to him, Ronnie Sr. emerged from the garage yelling out, "Allahu Akbar." Police ordered him to stop numerous times. They were like, "Stand still, do not move, do not take one more step." But of course, he didn't care. He kept yelling the same thing over and over again, "God is great." And they had no other choice but to taser him, which actually ended up subduing him. And then he was placed in the back of one of the police cars. And he was still shouting out, "God is great," in Arabic. Then he started yelling, "Kiki's the devil," quote, "The kids are the devil's kids."
Damn.
While he's being taken to the police station, little Ronnie was immediately medevaced to the Tampa General Hospital with little hope of survival. So now I'm going to tell you about the autopsy results. And obviously it's an autopsy. It's very gruesome and it's exceptionally sad when you think of one of the victims as being a 9-year-old little girl. Before I go into the autopsy, we're going to just take a quick break. Kiki's autopsy revealed that she'd been shot with a shotgun twice. She had a shotgun wound to her right back shoulder and a larger wound to her right elbow. Her right arm was broken in two places, but none of these wounds were lethal, which is surprising because I always think if you get shot with a shotgun, like, it's just a horrible injury. It was the beating with a shotgun that ended up causing her death. She had 7 fractures to her skull, including her jaw, fractured facial bones behind her lips, and several more fractures at the base of her skull. In all, she had 15 separate lacerations to her head, mainly on the left side, and her teeth were knocked out. This resulted in a severe brain hemorrhage and, of course, her death. Ranivia, her cause of death was listed as homicidal violence, including chop, blade, and penetrating wounds. That's what her autopsy said. She had knife and axe wounds.
What?
Yeah. On her head, neck, torso, and foot.
What the hell?
Her spinal cord had been severed and her jaw was broken.
Oh.
There were a lot more wounds than that I'm not going to go into. It's just overkill. She also had full thickness burns to her total body surface area.
Her entire body?
Yeah. I don't know exactly what full thickness burns means, but I'm assuming it just means she was just completely
burned. That poor child.
Yeah, I know. And we're going to hear more about her last minutes alive when I get into little Ronnie's testimony at court. It's so fucking sad. After being rushed to Tampa General Hospital, little Ronnie underwent emergency surgery. They tried to repair all the injuries inflicted by his father with a knife. He'd been stabbed on his neck, abdomen, chest, and extremities. He ended up, as I said earlier, with a collapsed lung, and he suffered burns on 30% of his body.
Wow.
Somehow, after all these injuries and even being disemboweled, he managed to survive and ended up providing a detailed account of the massacre that occurred in his Pike Lake home on the night of March 18th. Little Ronnie spoke with the child protection team during a forensic interview, and then he actually ended up speaking later against his father at a trial. According to little Ronnie, this is what happened that night. It was a Sunday night. He had school in the morning, and it was about 11:30, so he was in bed sleeping when he heard his parents just arguing, fighting. He kind of got a sense it was over religion, because they'd been fighting about that recently, and he recognized some of the words his dad was saying. He got up out of bed and opened his door to see what was going on. That's when Kiki yelled at him to get back in his room. He heard his father repeatedly crying out, "Allahu Akbar." And then his mom ran down the hallway into Renivia's room, where she ended up hiding in the closet. Ronnie Sr. followed behind her, and little Ronnie recognized that he had a shotgun in his hand. It was a shotgun that Kiki always kept under her mattress. Renivia was laying on her bed. She had school in the morning, too. And imagine her surprise and the helplessness she feels as her mom runs into her closet and her dad is following with a gun. From his bedroom door, little Ronnie could see his dad holding the shotgun up to his mom. And at some point during all this chaos, Ronnie fires a birdshot and it goes through Kiki's elbow. Little Ronnie heard the gun fire once, and then his father yelled out to him, quote, "Make me a real man. Say Allahu Akbar now. Get in here and kill this bitch right now."
He wanted little Ronnie to kill his mother?
Yes. Little Ronnie came into the room where his sister was laying helpless on the bed and his mother's hiding in the closet. And his father placed the shotgun in his hands and helped him hold it. He repeated the words, "Help kill this bitch." Little Ronnie couldn't remember if the gun fired or not.
He's probably fucking terrified.
Yeah, traumatized.
Right.
Next, his dad ordered him to go into the garage and to get his hunting knife and bring it to him. Little Ronnie went to the garage, but he couldn't find the specific knife that his dad was asking for. While he was walking from the garage into the kitchen, he saw his mom run out the front door and he saw his dad chasing her. And that's when Ronnie shot Kiki a second time. She managed to make it to the next door neighbor's house and pounded on their door. But Ronnie grabbed her, he knocked her to the ground, and that's when he beat her in the head at least 15 times with a shotgun. As Kiki lay dying, Ronnie ran back inside and into Renivia's room. She was still on her bed. He started yelling at little Ronnie to go in the living room, and he commanded him to walk in circles while repeating the phrase, "Allahu Akbar." At some point in the mayhem, Ronnie went into the garage, and he got an axe, and then he re-entered the house, and he grabbed Renivia. From the living room, little Ronnie could see his father take that tomahawk, raise it up, and hit little Renivia in the back. A tear streamed down her eyes. Then little Ronnie saw his dad take the tomahawk for a second time, and this time he hit little Renivia in the back of the head. Her eyes rolled back and blood was everywhere. Little Ronnie took off running as his father started stabbing Renivia. He ran into the kitchen, and then his father caught up with him, grabbed a knife from the kitchen drawer, and held it to little Ronnie and said, quote, "Don't say a word." Then Ronnie Sr. repeated the words, "God is my father," and viciously stabbed and disemboweled little Ronnie. While both of his children lay dying, Ronnie went into the garage and he grabbed a gas can. He came back into the house and he doused Renivia with the gas. He took a tissue and a match and he dropped it on her and he set her on fire. Then he spread some gasoline around the house, I believe it was the living room, and lit that on fire.
This is truly one of the sickest stories I've ever heard. I feel like I'm going to cry.
Just so everybody knows, I cried a lot in this story. So if I come across very cold-hearted, which we get hate mail about all the fucking time, you all don't know what it takes to do this, so, and to process it and to get to the point where we can share it. So don't judge us, especially if you're listening, because you're listening to true crime for entertainment.
This is just one of the fucking worst things I've ever heard. Seriously. I really feel like I'm going to cry.
But there is a beautiful twist to this horrible story. Little Ronnie was adopted by one of the original officers on the case.
Oh, really?
His name was Detective Blair. And Detective Blair had visited him while he was recovering in the hospital. At one point, little Ronnie was well enough to be released. And he ended up moving in with some relatives, but that didn't work out for whatever reason. And Detective Blair, along with his wife Danielle and their five children, PJ, Brittany, Seth, Hunter, Mike, and Madison, all agreed that little Ronnie belonged in their family. And in December of 2018, Ronnie Sr.'s parental rights were terminated, and the Blairs ended up legally adopting little Ronnie. They have what they call their family mantra, and it is, quote, "I'm safe, I'm loved, and I'm part of this family."
Talia.
I know. As you know, trials take a long time to happen. In 2020, trial preparations were still underway, and there was this pretrial hearing. And in this pretrial hearing, Ronnie says the craziest things, and I couldn't find the actual pretrial hearing, but I have some quotes that I want to share. He tells the judge, quote, "I'm ready to die like B.I.G. That's big. He was actually murdered. Just like I'm going to be, right? I was murdered a couple times already before. So I'm cool being murdered again and coming back like big."
Oh, fuck off.
Yeah, I'm like, what is that? What? Okay. Ronnie chose to ignore the old adage, a man who is his own lawyer has a fool for a client. And he petitioned the court to allow him to represent himself. A Feretta hearing, that's what it's called, was held to determine if Ronnie was competent enough to decide to be his own lawyer. And it was deemed that he was mentally competent. He could represent himself. Thus, a trial date was set for June of 2021.
I would not want to be his defense attorney.
Well, yeah. Then luckily, he did it himself. I think after what I'm going to play for you in a few minutes, you'll really question how competent he is. In his capacity as acting attorney, Ronnie is entitled to personally cross-examine all of the prosecutor's witnesses, including the lone survivor of his brutality, little Ronnie. He ends up questioning his son about the murder. During Ronnie O'Neill's opening statements, he accuses the police of tampering with evidence and asserts that he murdered Kiki in self-defense.
Okay.
He claims that Kiki murdered Renivia and attacked little Ronnie and that he had to kill her to protect his children.
He should fucking be ashamed of himself.
Ronnie O'Neill makes a lot of promises to the jury regarding the exposition of evidence to back up his claim, but he never presents anything other than his own declarations to support his assertions. Basically, he acts as if he said it, it's a fact, it's evidence. Here's some highlights of his opening statement.
The evidence is going to show that we are under some of the most vicious,
ever seen. By the time it's all said and done, you will see who is the mass murderer in Tampa Bay, the state of Florida. You will know why what occurred on March 18, 2018 occurred. And the evidence is going to show that law enforcement tampered with evidence to meet their such high burden of proof. Because originally, it wasn't enough. So we had to tamper with evidence. The evidence is going to show my son did not see me murder his mom. The evidence is going to show he did not see me shoot his mom. The evidence is going to show my son said many things that are not true. The evidence is going to show that I called 911 during Kenyatta Barron's 911 call. But all of a sudden, it ends up after I called Kenyatta, after Kenyatta Barron's call was made, now I'm calling 911. But originally, I called 911 without even knowing she called 911 during her call. But the evidence is going to show that your representatives and law enforcement, local law enforcement, wanted to make it seem like I'm some kind of menace to society. And I ran after killing Kenyatta Barron, knowing that authority was on the way to kill my own children. I wonder why I would do something like that for no reason. And I'm standing here competent as can be, representing myself today.
He does what I do. He makes the word sound like it's a real word, but it ain't. He's like the fabrication of evidence. Like literally. And I'm like, what? So that's a little bit crazy.
Yeah, a little.
The prosecutors called neighbors, first responders, and some other people to the stand so they could describe what they saw and heard that night. Testimony by firefighter David Foster, who found Renivia's slaughtered body in the master bedroom, brought the courtroom to tears. When the prosecutor presented all the witnesses, he then called little Ronnie, who ended up testifying from a remote location via video conference. Of course, the prosecutor asked little Ronnie questions about that night, and then Ronnie Sr. was allowed to cross-examine his son, who by that time was 11. And the situation is just surreal. You are about to hear the words from a very courageous and very brave little boy who's being questioned by the very man, his father, who stabbed him, poured gasoline all around him, and let him catch on fire. Here's some clips from that testimony.
How you doing?
Good.
Good to see you, man.
Good to see you, too.
Did you see me beat your mom?
No.
Did you see me shoot your mom?
No.
Are you sure?
Yes.
But you did hear a shot that night. Is that correct?
Yes.
Do you know where your mom was shot at? And what part of the body she was shot in? Do you know anything about that?
You said where she was shot?
Yes, sir. Do you know where your mom was shot at?
No.
You did not see me shoot your mom or beat your mom. Is that correct?
Yes.
Did I hurt you that night of this incident?
Yes.
I did. And how did I hurt you?
You stabbed me.
You heard that gunshot that night. Was your sister hurt already? Or was she hurt after that shot?
She was hurt after that.
All right. What do you remember happening after the shooting with your mom outside?
You're coming back inside and you're getting my sister and then putting her in my parents' room, and then you hit her with an axe.
Now you just said that I came back in and took your sister from her room to your mom's room and hit her with an axe, right?
Yes.
Now, you just said a while ago that I told you to go get some things. What did I tell you to go get?
A knife.
Now, you said that I got some matches or some objects and lit some things on fire. Is that correct?
Yes.
You saw me sprinkle gasoline over your sister's body. Is that correct? Or you said that I sprayed gasoline everywhere. Is that right?
Yes.
Is that a yes?
Yes.
And you said that I had my foot on you and went to strike you or strike a match and set you on fire. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Very good.
All right.
Very good. So tell me that's not sad.
Oh, man. This is a tough one.
After 2 weeks of trial, the prosecutor rested their case, as did Ronnie. But not before giving a very bizarre closing argument in which he continues to say that he was basically framed and it was self-defense, all in one.
Oh, okay.
It didn't take long for the jury to reach a verdict on June 22nd. They found him guilty of murder, arson, and a whole list of other crimes. So now that he was found guilty, the question is, should he be put to death? A few days later, the jury voted to spare Ronnie from the death sentence. And he was given 3 life sentences plus 60 years. And the reason why the judge believes that he didn't get death is because, I'm going to paraphrase, because the jury thinks he's fucking nuts. She basically says that him being his own attorney probably helped spare his life because it showed him
just unhinged.
And how pathetic he is. Yes, yeah. And unhinged. Perfect. Unhinged. I'm going to play you a clip of his reaction to his sentencing and a bit of what Judge Michelle Sisko, who presided over the trial, had to say.
I am not sorry for something I didn't do. And I am not sorry for the things I did do.
Mr. O'Neill. All right. Listen, stop right. Stop. All right. Listen to me.
You're
not going to raise your voice again.
I'm not. But I will say, I'm sorry for your loss.
19 years I've been at this job. I've seen human beings killed at the hands of others in every way imaginable. You name it, I've seen it. Shootings, stabbings, drownings, suffocating. Blown apart by cars and DUI manslaughter cases. Horrible things. This is the worst case I have ever seen as far as the facts go. When the person from fire department, when he testified, and when he said that he retrieved the body of Ronivia O'Neill from the home, and all he could do was sob. It took every ounce I had not to start sobbing too. Because there is no way any person with any feeling could have witnessed or seen the photos of what occurred that night and not be haunted for the rest of your life. I know I will be. For the rest of my life, I'll be haunted by what I saw as far as the evidence. The way that Ms. Barron died was horrific. And that 911 call, which captured truly all of it, you heard, and everyone who's heard that 911 call heard a death scream. If anybody ever wants to know what it sounds like before a human being dies, knowing that their death is imminent, that's exactly what it is. That was a death scream.
Mm-hmm. We don't see if it's true.
But what happened to little Ranivia and to little Ronnie, but I'm going to focus on Ranivia, because she was special. And you could tell Miss Barron had done everything she could to create a beautiful home for her family. She did, Kenyatta did everything she could. Little Ranivia, she couldn't scream. She couldn't run away. Mm-hmm. And she witnessed what you did to her mother for shooting her mother in the arm with the gunshot. She knew. And the horror that that child suffered. But the pain and suffering that she suffered that night at your hands, unspeakable, absolutely unspeakable. And at the moment, that first time you struck her with that hatchet, and little Ronnie testified that all he could see was tears coming out of his sister's face. At that moment, that child knew she was being betrayed in the cruelest, most tragic and sorrowful way that a child could ever be betrayed. She was being betrayed by her parent, the one person that should be there to protect their children and love them and keep them from harm. And that was the last thing that child felt before she passed on from this earth, was your utter, cruel betrayal to her. Ranivia O'Neill is one of the bravest souls I have ever come across in my 54 years on this planet. One of the bravest ever, ever. Because she suffered so traumatically.
I am speechless, and I know I've been speechless a few times before in episodes, but it's just so terrible.
I watched all of the trial that was on YouTube. And I got my information from that. And I also got my information from the autopsy report and some other court records. One was from the Child Protective Services. I can't remember the exact name of the department. So I know that it's all accurate. And I know that it's very, as I said, very, very sad. That being said, Ronnie O'Neill is currently serving out his time in Florida. And it gives me some sort of comfort knowing that little Ronnie is surrounded by a family that loves him and is going to help him, give him all the resources he needs to get over this if he possibly can. So that's the Ronnie O'Neill story. I want to take a second to thank two of our patrons who recommended this, Alana C. and Crystal M. Thank you for the suggestion. I was a pisser and I'm so sorry.
I know. I'm not even going to thank you for that one. I hope little Ronnie gets lots of help and love, and it sounds like he is. And yes, that's the small glimmer of comfort and hope that I get from this story. So,
besides the sources already listed, YouTube and court records, I also use some articles from Child Fatality Report. That's where I got the information. I also read a bunch of articles from the TampaBay.com news source, and I think that's about it. I want to thank you guys all for sticking around and listening to that. I know it was a tough one. If you haven't done so already, I'm going to ask one more time for you to hit the subscribe/follow button on whatever app you're listening to right now. If you enjoy the show and you want to get some ad-free early releases. Early releases of our public episodes and ad-free releases of our public episodes, plus over 100 exclusive episodes not released to the public, you can go to our Patreon page. It's Patreon, P-A-R-T-R-E-O-N.
No, it's not.
P-A-T. Well, whatever. It's patreon.com/TNT Crimes. It's also in our show notes. You can go to our website. At our website, you can find all the information on our merchandise and Patreon. And that address is crimesandconsequences.com. Plus, we also have an Apple channel. So if you're listening to us on the Apple podcast, go ahead and look at our channel and subscribe.
And they are the same episodes as you can find on Patreon.
Yep. And please check out our social media. It is at Hardcore True Crime for both Instagram and Facebook.
And that'll do it.
I hope so, because that's a lot.
It is.
And I got to stop now. I'm done for the day.
I need to go like
to
sit in a corner and rock or something. So anyway, until our next episode.
Maybe listen to the Carpenters or something soothing.
Something very soothing.
Don't kill each other.
Bye.
Bye.